Thank you for tuning in to Untold Civil War. Before we get started, I want to thank all my patrons on Patreon for their support. You too can join their mighty ranks using the link in the show notes. For as low as $3 a month, not only will you get advance notice of interviews I have coming up, for a few more dollars a month, you'll be able to ask your own questions ahead of time. This is a great opportunity to get access to these Civil War experts from around the country. And now, throw another log on the fire. Get the coffee pot going. Let's delve into some Untold Civil War. Welcome to the Untold Civil War podcast. And today I have Daniel C. with me, and we're going to be talking about the interesting topic of the Asian American experience, not only during the Civil War, but in modern day reenacting. So thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this interesting topic. And can you remind us a little bit about your background? Also, how long have you been reenacting?
Sure thing. So for those who don't know, my name is Daniel C. I started as a history major at the College of William Mary in 2016. That was my graduation date. And then I worked in museums for about 3 to 4 years afterwards, full-time. First Colonial Williamsburg, then Claremore Farm. And I did a lot of other programs alongside the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, Jamestown, Yorktown, among others. And tons of volunteer activities on top of that, including reenacting. Currently, though, I work as a financial analyst for a bank. So a little of a career change there. But I stayed in reenacting and I continue to do this research on the side. It's one of my passion projects. Something, as you can tell, I'm quite personally invested in as well. Something that I think it's connects to me on a very deep personal level, because as I was going through their histories and their stories, it kind of reminded me of my own like story coming to the United States as like an adult and trying to kind of blend in and find my own space. I guess just also one more disclosure too. I started reenacting when I was about 18. I saw a bunch of people looking, you know, really funky looking with some funny hats, and they're all carrying guns. And they asked me like, "Hey kid, you want to do, you know, do you want to blow stuff up?" And like any self-respecting 18-year-old, I was like, "Of course, let's go." So full disclosure too, my first love was 18th century, American Revolution to be precise. I only got into Civil War in particular a couple years ago. Living in D.C., you can't throw a rock here without hitting a Civil War battle site of some kind. Also, I live in Virginia too, so in Williamsburg in particular as well. So like surrounded, neck deep in Civil War over there.
So was it living in that area that you sort of got your love for the Civil War? I know that's relatively recent considering your career, 2 years, but was it the area, or what exactly was it that brought you to Civil War?
For me, actually, was when I moved to D.C. When I don't know, living in Williamsburg, I knew that Civil War was present and was there. But then I started living in D.C. and I was like, okay, you know, all the Civil War events are usually, you know, much further down south or much more north. So I started looking into Civil War because there's a bunch of different things. And that's when I got to link up with a person that kind of influenced me very much. His name is Stephen Fan, a fantastic park ranger for the NPS. And he was working at the Defenses of Washington. And he got me linked up with the Asian side of Civil War, the Asian history. His research was fantastic. Got me hooked.
Yeah, we've had Steve Fan on the podcast, and we've talked, and he is a really great guy, really great inspiration, and particularly doing great stuff, really putting Asian Americans out there in the community. So great shout out to him. When you reenact the Civil War, who do you portray exactly? Are you portraying a certain unit? Are you attached to a certain unit?
I like to call this the blob, basically. I just go to whatever unit is doing some really cool activities in particular. And I try to mold my impression based on that unit that's in the field, basically. But thankfully, since I do federal, it's really easy. Most of the time, it's just, oh, maybe I'll go with the frock coat here, or, you know, a sack coat there. Maybe switch out the hat. Maybe switch out the badge. So it makes things a whole lot easier.
History Fix is the streaming service for us history nerds. With the new Napoleon movie coming out in November, why not subscribe to History Fix and watch all their Napoleonic content? No other way to prep for the Emperor coming to the big screen. Link in the show notes. Well, now, maybe just to get into the personal side of it and things, as Asian Americans are coming into the reenacting community, what has that experience been like? Do you know a little bit about that, the reception of that?
Honestly, I think it's been interesting lately, because initially when I first got in, people were like telling me, oh yeah, you know, there's a good chance that Asians were there, but they wouldn't be able to give me a good answer about that too. Like they said, I imagine they were there, but they couldn't come up with concrete examples. And sometimes I'll get visitors asking me if I was supposed to be there. And that kind of hurt a little bit, because I was like, well, for us reenactors, actors, like they could tell like, hey, you know, my kid is on point. You know, there's hand stitching here. Like everything is squared away. but visitors, they could never get beyond like the face, basically. And it's like a very shallow approach. And I was like, I feel like I wasn't being given like, there's also like a barrier constantly there, preventing us from like educating the public. And I know it wasn't coming out of malice. They were genuinely curious, but it always feel like a little barrier there between me and interacting with the public.
But what's interesting, though, is that yes, right? That is historically accurate because there were Asians in the country, in the nation at that time, even going back further, right? Can we talk about some of the early Asian immigration to the United States?
Yeah, so that's something that kind of launched me to my current passion project of researching Asian American history in the United States. All the books usually start talking about Asian immigration in 1848 onwards, with the discovery of the California of gold in California and the California Gold Rush. The name of Gamsam was kind of coined from Cantonese immigrants coming to California. The nickname was Gold Mountain, basically, to call the United States Gold Mountain. And they all came here looking for gold. They ended up spreading throughout, becoming laborers, working in the railroads, and establishing businesses, the most common of which was being like restaurants and laundries. And that's where the kind of stereotype started because of these first wave of immigration. But the thing is, as I was digging deeper into the historical archives, I was able to dig up some primary documents like runaway ads, descriptions, and encounters of maybe a couple dozen to a couple hundred Asians coming to the United States. So for a reference point in context, in the 18th century, most of them are being referred to as East Indian. That's the term that people of the period called Asians, as opposed to the West Indies. So West Indies think Caribbean, East Indies being from, East Asia in this case. But to Europeans and North America, European North Americans, the difference there wasn't really worth splitting hairs over. So they'll label everyone from Asia as East Indian. It didn't matter if you're from Japan, China, Southeast Asia, or the Philippines. And keep in mind for the listener too, as well, Asia is a pretty big place with a lot of complexity and diverse cultures there. So in their descriptions from in a Western context, they kind of can't find a more precise location for these people. So that's a lot of the challenges with researching. Like we have an overall idea that like they're definitely not white, definitely not black, definitely probably Asian, but pinpointing exactly where they're from is particularly difficult. So based on documentation, we can tell that a lot of these Asians coming to North America in the 18th century, so think 1750s, 1770s, 1780, probably coming from Southeast Asia, Bangladesh, and India in particular. We have evidence for about four people coming from India and Bangladesh, and they were serving in the American Revolution, two for the Americans, two for the British. The British are usually serving as drummers and buglers. Americans are actually taking up arms. Probably the poster child for this is going to be a gentleman called Charles Peters. He's going to be enslaved in Pondicherry, India. He's going to go from a French colony to an English colony, and he's going to be brought over to Charleston, where he's enslaved by a loyalist master, basically. And when the American Revolution happens, he proceeds to argue and sue his owner, saying like, "Oh, since I'm property and property of a Tory or a loyalist, I should be confiscated, given my freedom and allowed to join the Continental Army." And it first goes through a series of judicial fights. It's a whole like Judge Judy episode, basically. It goes from county level to state level, and finally he wins the suit, is given his freedom, and enlists. And I think the 5th North Carolina Regiment goes on to serve in Valley Forge and Monmouth. Eventually, though, his trail kind of vanishes a little bit. We suspect that he ends up captured at Charleston, for the Siege of Charleston, which is one of those worst defeats of the U.S. Army. He ends up in Barbados, where he serves in a loyalist unit by switching sides, basically. But this is research is ongoing. We're not quite sure yet. Still work in progress. But all these people are coming as usually enslaved people or servants. And we also have evidence of them coming as sailors as well. Three Chinese people are popping up in Baltimore, 1782. We have the ship manifest and like three distinct Chinese characters where they put their names in, basically. Unfortunately, I'm trying to get it translated, but the Chinese characters are a little bit illegible, which to me seems to me that these guys are probably illiterate. And it helps explain why we don't have a lot of documentation about earlier Chinese immigration or Asian immigration to the United States, because these people have the same challenges as researching working class and enslaved people in the 18th, 19th centuries. They were mostly illiterate sometimes, and if they left historical records, they wouldn't have been preserved because they wouldn't have been deemed important enough to be preserved. And even if they were preserved, they're probably sitting in their own home countries where the 20th century has not been very kind to Asian records. You know, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, you know, the Cultural Revolution in China. It doesn't lead well to historical preservation all that much, especially of fragile paper documents.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Michael Sievers, the writer, producer, and creator of The Silver King's War, a podcast series about my father's Second World War as a B-26 bombardier. Stanley L. Silverfield, a first lieutenant in the United States Army Air Corps from Birmingham, Alabama, rode in the nose, the greenhouse of the famed Martin Marauder. You can find The Silver King's War wherever you listen to podcasts.
Love our audio content? Check out our YouTube channel for our video content. Watch legendary Detective Girardi bust Civil War myths. Get eyes on the most amazing Civil War relics and private collections. And learn all about untold Civil War curiosities. Link in the show notes.
There are a couple things that you mentioned that I kind of think is interesting, because it's like how some things just are very similar. Even when you had Germans coming in, one of the largest immigrants represented in the Union Army, right, were the Germans. And they were all referred to as Dutch, right? and then, of course, when you talk about the gold rush, I always tell people the people who got rich during the gold rush were not the ones who actually did the mining. It was the guys who were selling the pickaxe and the shovel, right? And it made sense that, like, a lot of the Asians who came over that you mentioned started those laundry business and those restaurants. I'm sure business people way ahead of their time, in a sense.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that started, we kind of stereotype today as, you know, typical being Asian American, started there as well. Case in point, the Chinese laundry, the Chinese restaurant being there. Unfortunately, it wasn't because like they had a lot of choice. There was a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment, and that comes with the kind of yellow peril movement. Westerners consider the Asiatic racist, quote-unquote, as an existential dread to Western civilization. They had this big fear that Japan and China would kind of unite, and as a huge yellow horde would just descend upon Western world and just basically destroy everything that Europe and North America kind of stood for. But this is a little bit after the Civil War, so think like 1870s, 1880s, the culmination of which being the Chinese Exclusion Act, and which will eventually, grow to encompass the entirety of Asia, basically freezing anybody from Asia ever stepping foot in the West and gaining citizenship, with like very few exceptions.
1863 Designs and I have just finished a collaborative custom project. Process was smooth, the pricing reasonable, and the quality of workmanship just absolutely superb. Ty, graphic designer for 1863 Designs, brought to life my dream of a pocket-sized card to serve as a checklist for those attempting to hunt for Civil War CDVs online or at shows. This product will soon be available on our website, but if you have a custom project in mind, please reach out to Ty at the link in the show notes.
Well, bringing it back to the Civil War, do we have examples of Asian Americans serving North or South? And also, you know, we talk about this discrimination, and, you know, we've all watched the movie Glory and we've seen that. But did Asian Americans serve in their own units? Did they serve along their white counterparts? And how were they treated? Do we know anything about that?
That's a very interesting question, because in the Civil War, this kind of anti-Chinese sentiment hasn't really developed yet. It's not widespread. Very few people ever heard of China at this point in time. Even fewer people ever met a Chinese person. So that Asian migration is still in its kind of early phases. So I think the Asian community is maybe only a couple hundred to a couple thousand at best. But we have evidence of roughly about 50 to 70 Asian people serving in both sides of the Civil War. And according to all the research we've seen, in particular, one fantastic book, article actually, written by Angela He, titled Mulatto, Indian, or What? The Racialization of Chinese Soldiers in the American Civil War. Since they were neither black or white, they were kind of considered both, and they were kind of seen in this, the term that she uses in her paper is very great. it's a liminal racial space, neither fully white and not fully black. Maybe it's a little bit of both here and there. And it just depended on how they enlisted and their social class background. So we'll take one example in this case, probably the poster child that everybody knows of when they talk about Asian soldiers in the Civil War. It's a case of, let's see here. Yes, Corporal Joseph Pierce. And that's also another challenge for researching Asian Civil War. Almost all of them, when they come to enlist, they're given American names, so they don't really stand out too much. But anyway, going back to Joseph Pierce, he is going to be the poster child of Asian Civil War because he's probably one of the most documented. We actually have a photo of him that is plastered anywhere we talk about Chinese soldiers in the Civil War. He's going to serve in the 14th Connecticut Infantry. His background is that he was adopted by the Pierce family from Connecticut, which were missionaries and traders, and they were hardcore congregationalists. So they were very, very pro-abolition. So they're going to go to China and they're going to adopt Joseph Pierce, bring him back to Connecticut. And the Pierce family is pretty kind of prominent in their local community of Berlin, Connecticut. And as such, like, Joseph Pierce is considered like white by all his peers because of the social standing of the family. And the Pierce family basically treat him like their own kid. You know, he's baptized, he's educated, and he's like living and doing almost everything else that everybody else is doing at the time in the family. So when basically one of the younger sons enlists, he proceeds to go ahead and also enlist in the 14th Connecticut Regiment. And it's kind of this high, you know, local prominence in the community basically gives him a pass to serve as, you know, basically, you know, quote unquote white. And that's why I think he eventually becomes a corporal, a non-commissioned officer, low as it may be.
Do we know anything about his motivations of why he wanted to enlist? Was it probably, you know, because his friends or his community was enlisting? Do we know anything about that? Was he a hardcore abolitionist?
I'm afraid not. Like, his personal feelings are not known, but I suspect that a lot of his, you know, sense of community was, you know, joining, as well as his own family, and because of his own familial background being adopted by such a pro-abolitionist family, that probably contributed a lot to, you know, him joining as well.
So you've done it all. The kids got seasick on the ferry to see the Statue of Liberty. Wife hated the crowded pools at your last Caribbean resort. Need more vacation ideas? See the link in the show notes and reach out to Civil War Trails. They'll have you kayaking, hiking, cycling, some historic sites that you and the family will never forget. Your next vacation might just be a Civil War trail in your backyard.
Any examples of Asian American Confederates, I wonder?
Yes. I'm not sure if you know of them, but there's a very famous Cheng and Ang, the very famous Siamese twins that gave the term of, you know, Siamese twin in the first place. They eventually settled in North Carolina and they married into a prominent like Southern family at that time, basically. They were rumored to be half Asian themselves, but I don't know about that. But they have two kids, Christopher Wren and I think another one. And since they're growing up in like North Carolina, Surrey, North Carolina in particular, they go on ahead to join the Confederate Army and they serve in a cavalry regiment. They're, I think one of them is captured by Union forces. Like, they kind of make note of him being like not white, but because of his like prominent family, like the Confederates are basically like, no, he's an honorary white, basically.
Gotcha. And so really what I'm seeing here is that most of them, from what you're saying, is they were treated fairly well by their fellow pards, even though maybe they don't know exactly their background, but they weren't completely ostracized either from serving.
No, they weren't completely ostracized either. One particular example that came in was during the New York draft riot. New York was engulfed in race riots, basically, because of this anti-immigrant or anti, you know, African-American sentiment took hold. This is resentment. There was an effort by the mob to try to target Chinese immigrants in New York as well. But reportedly, like, the mob was started to infight among themselves, saying like, no, we should only target African-Americans, leave the Chinamen out of this. There was a lot of mob infighting. So there's this argument to say that even in like that racialized discourse of the Civil War, Asians occupied this kind of liminal gray zone where, like, some people consider them colored, some they consider them white, and even amongst people who are anti, you know, colored people, they're like, well, should we lump Chinese people in there or not? I don't know, maybe. And I think to illustrate that too, there's this case of John Tommy. It's going to be in the 1st Regiment, Excelsior Brigade, under Major General Daniel Sickles at Gettysburg. He's probably one of those that I think is the best example of this kind of liminal space. He's going to be remarked as explicitly Chinese in a lot of the documentation of the time period. And this is anecdotal at best, but I think it's a great illustration of this situation where he's going to be captured at Fredericksburg, brought to John Magruder. And Magruder's both saying like, okay, you're clearly not white, you're clearly not black. Are you mulatto, Indian, or what? And then John Tommy said, no, I'm Chinese. And Magruder's like, ah, of course, totally, sure. So what it would take to have you join the Confederate side instead? And John Tommy, you know, supposedly answered, oh yeah, make me a bit of Brigadier General, then we'll talk. So there's that. It's pretty funny. It's anecdotal at best, but I think illustrate the fact that to Confederates and Union force alike, Chinese were kind of this middle ground, saying like they could go either way, because there's a case of A. Moore, who is a Chinese person, but because of his, I guess, color of the skin or because of the context around him in Connecticut, I think he's from Rhode Island. When he went enlisted, they may know things. We've got black eyes, black hair. I think you're mulatto, so they put him in the USCT.
Are you a fan of Civil War Army engineers? Perhaps you can't get enough of the Zouaves. Maybe you just love reading firsthand accounts by those who were there. The Excelsior Brigade offers you a chance to own original CDVs of Army engineers, ambrotypes of Zouaves, and even original wartime correspondence. Link in the show notes.
That's very interesting. It's interesting that in this time period, I guess part of it must be there were so few in comparison to other immigrants, I guess. So it's like, you know, when you're looking down at the file of how to like document all of this, you know, the bureaucracy of things, there's no box for that. So what do? Like, you can't check that box, right? So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, in an age of black and white, they're like, well, you're clearly not either. What do we do?
And do we have any other firsthand accounts that talk about maybe how they were treated or how their actual parts serving with them, how they treated them or anything like that?
John Thomas probably the best example and most well-documented one. We have evidence of him being treated sort of okay-ish when he was captured at Fredericksburg. There's this case where they actually refer to him as Yankee Chinaman, basically, where somebody like actually put him over their knee and like proceeded to like, you know, belt him. It's very patronizing, basically, but I think mostly because like they're trying to humiliate a Yankee, and like the whole language around the situation implies to me that his biggest sin was not being a Chinaman, was because he was a Yankee, really, fighting for the Union side. Like, that was his biggest sin. He was not given, like, worse treatment compared to other Union prisoners at that time. And most definitively, he was given better treatment than other colored troops captured by Confederates, which is well documented as being given no quarter and massacred to a man, almost.
What happened to these characters after the war? Do we know?
I know for a fact that we have other evidence of... Let's start with like the post-trial. Corporal Joseph Pierce, I think he eventually goes back to Connecticut. He leads a pretty calm life afterwards. John Tommy from the 1st Regiment Excelsior Brigade doesn't have a happy ending. He proceeds to get his legs blown off at Gettysburg. So he unfortunately passed away. And that's where we have a lot of his documentation. His obituary pops up in the New York Times. And they make a note saying like he is the only Chinaman serving in the Union Army, which is objectively false. We have other documentation for others once. But he was like seen as like this poster child, saying like, yes, even a foreigner from faraway China sees the justice of our cause. Like, let's, you know, he was a lion amongst men, well regarded by his compatriots, you know, there we go, you know, up with the stars, down with the traitors, hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. Yeah, Christopher Rembunker, one of the sons from on the Confederate side from the Siamese twins, I think eventually also goes back to his home. They're all slaveholders, so they're, you know, after, but they end up fine. They're going to be fine. But the thing is, like, we have evidence of Filipinos and Thais also serving in the Union Navy as well. There's evidence of also Filipinos of what you call Chinamen, basically, but they're probably Filipinos in the Louisiana Zouave units in particular, the Louisiana Tigers, which are all raised from like Creoles from like New Orleans. I think they also end up fine as well. There's evidence of like one Asian veteran going back because he's a native of, I think, Thailand as well. He actually goes back, serves as a mercenary, like training all their troops basically on the latest like tactics. I'm really sorry about his name for his case, but he has a fascinating story. Combat veteran, everything. Like, he got injured, he got his leg shot, but he made a full recovery almost. So like their fates are very different. Going from, like, you know, not making it out to going back home to eventually just living their lives in the United States as usual. But the thing is, one thing I want to single out and emphasize, that even though a lot of them might eventually go back to their communities, especially for the ones that are not given the status of like white person, eventually they struggle to get citizenship and get payments or basically their due justice, basically, as veterans, because eventually after the Civil War, 1867, that's when the peak anti-Chinese settlement starts. You know, they're denied citizenship and they're going to struggle for years to, you know, to get recognized. And majority of them never do. They never get pensions. A lot of them get citizenship outright refused.
We don't know if any of them joined like the GAR or anything like that, do we?
Not that I'm aware of. But that's the thing. Their stories are really hard to track and research.
It is amazing the lengths to which many reenactors go to ensure that their impression is perfect. One of your best resources as a reenactor is the Badge Maker. From him, you can get your core badges, cloth and metal. You can get your ID discs, camp hats, watch fobs, and smoking pipes. The mark of a dedicated reenactor is the fact that he's equipped by the Badge Maker.
And after learning about these different stories, which you've shared with us, which are so fascinating, how has that changed your outlook on your role as a reenactor, as a historian in this space? I'm just curious because like we talked about that surface area where you were standing there going, do I really belong here? Or, you know, when people are asking you that. And now after reading these stories, yes, absolutely, because there were Asian Americans there. I mean, has that changed your outlook on things? Does that change your answer now when you get asked that?
Yes and no, in the sense of like, it's cool to be able to tell people that like, yes, we can document Asians in the 18th, 19th centuries. But my mission has always been to tell American history because it is important to reinforce the fact that it's always been about we the people. And while the definition of we the people might have changed throughout time, I don't think their stories have. Like throughout, like if, it doesn't matter if it's Asian history, Irish history, or, you know, Jewish American history, like all throughout them, like we always have the same parallels. People coming here, whether it's been a, you know, looking for a better life or through unhappy circumstances, like being, you know, enslaved, there's always a boat. There's always a journey. There's always that struggle for acceptance in American society, eventual progress. That progress is very slow. For a lot of immigrant groups in the United States, it's still not a complete process. It's still a work in progress, an ongoing fight. But we're always walking towards that, I guess, the ever more perfect union of, you know, that we always claim to be. And the reason why I do this research when I bring about this inequality is not because I want to shame people into it, saying like, oh, look how bad this was, blah, blah, no. It's not out of shame. It's because the U.S. has always tried to strive to be this place of quality, freedom, pursuit of happiness. And while the U.S. has never quite lived up to these ideas in the past, there's nothing stopping us from trying to live up to these ideas today. It's cool that I can like try and engage others too as well, and not just Asian Americans or Asians coming to the United States, but also other people from other social groups too, saying like, hey, it's been an ongoing process and it's your story too now as well.
I think what you just said there was very important and poignant. I really appreciate you laying that out very clearly. I think there's a lot of people who would like to say what you just said, but can't find the words, and you did it beautifully. Something I'd like to bring up as well is if there's people who want to get into this reenacting space, maybe coming from an Asian American background, or like you said, any other background, is there any advice you have to them about basically sharing in this American story that is now part of their history coming here now?
Yes, I would say don't get discouraged because you're not exactly what people might call the poster card of a particular history time period. If you're Indian or if you're, you know, Middle Eastern or from a different ethnicity that's not necessarily portrayed American history too much, don't let this dissuade you. With that being said, I am not going to sugarcoat it. It will be difficult and you will get difficult questions. But that's why I'm lucky to have a lot of really good people, researchers to back me up in this case. Stephen Fan, I've seen other fantastic resources start to come up now. And in particular, we're seeing a resurgence and research coming from often neglected time periods in history and often neglected social groups in history. Cheney McKnight, Marvin Alonzo Greer have done fantastic work bringing African-American history to the forefront and explaining these lesser known groups as well. But that is an increasing dialogue happening about who got to do what, as well as like bringing like more people that are not exactly described as like what people like pop history. When you see the image of the Civil War, like you think of like, you know, the Irish Battalion, or you think of Pickett's Charge, but there's other stories along that. And the people are doing, you know, much better work now to bring these stories to the limelight and say like, hey, let's not to say like we should totally, you know, say like, these are the only stories we talk about now, but to add a bit more complexity and nuance to it, because like anything, history is very complex and nuanced. When you add all these, you know, people of color, as well as more diversity in the Civil War, I want to emphasize to other reenactors as well. It's not because we want to detract from what's usually told, we're just going to add to it as well. And so for those people of color coming or minorities coming to reenacting, I'll let you know, like, it is primarily, you know, white male dominated. Absolutely. But there's an increasing movement of younger people now trying to bring more discourse about lesser known time periods. You'll get tough questions. Don't let it discourage you, but also lean on others, people like me, Marvin, or Cheney, to give you assistance, and we'll try to help as best you can. You might have to do some more research on your own to narrow down, because of full disclosure, there's so much I don't know, and I have such a limited amount of time. So if you want to particularly portray something, go for it. Research, we'll do the best we can. We'll point to databases and people who might be experts, but some of the effort will probably have to come from yourself. Likewise, like, if a group doesn't necessarily welcome you, or if you feel a lot of hostility, let them know, like saying like, okay, if that's not the people like I'm looking for, then go elsewhere. There are a ton of groups that are, you know, good people.
Want to keep up to date with the show? Follow us on Instagram and Facebook. There you'll get all updates about new episodes released, see our book of the month, and much more. Link in the show notes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you mentioned some of these resources. Like you said, in the history world, not everything is handed to you on a silver platter, right? Here's your information, a quick Wikipedia search, right? Some of the fun part is actually doing the research. That's why we like getting into this hobby and doing that research. Are there any resources that you would recommend to people? I know you mentioned a couple books there, a couple authors, a couple specialists. Are there any titles that you could recommend to anyone? I know, like you said, limited resources these days, but is there anything out there?
Yes. For a baseline of understanding why Asians are coming to North America, I recommend this book, Philadelphia and the China Trade, 1682 to 1846 by Jonathan Goldstein. I have it here myself. Highly recommend. It's one of my favorites. Also, I would say Arthur Booner's Alas, What Brought Thee Here, The Chinese in New York, 1800 to 1950 is a good one. Angela He's Bulatto Indian or What? The Racialization of Chinese Soldiers in the American Civil War, Volume 9, Article 5, May 2019 is probably required reading for any Asian reenactor that wants to come into this, I think. Confederate, it's a little bit difficult because the records are not as good. Like I said, we probably have evidence of Christopher Wren Bunker joining the Confederates, so as Filipino sailors, Louisiana Creoles, what you call Filipinos, but at the time it was called Chinamen, because Americans are like, well, you're technically Filipino, but like, it's close enough. Probably there as well. For that, I recommend O'Donnell Rosada's Hispanic Confederates, Genealogical Publishing Group, 2006. It's a good one, I think, to give you like a launching point for that. Stephen Fan's brochures that he published for the NPS also is a good jumping point as well.
And of course, if people want to contact you and see your content, how can they do that?
I'd probably say like contact me through email. It's going to be dsih1771@gmail.com, or follow me on Instagram too. Always happy to answer any questions, comments, harsh criticisms too. Just lay it on me.
Well, you know, thank you so much. And like I said, you've graciously allowed people to invited people to contact you if they want to get into this hobby or learn more. So I'm definitely going to put a link to your social media, at least in the show notes, so people can get access to you, follow you to learn more.
Yes. Full disclosure, if you want to come out and do reacting with me, I have pretty high standards. I don't take shortcuts. So you better be ready for a lot of hand stitching. Full disclosure, reacting can be a very expensive hobby, but with the right investments, you can have a great kit. And I think people say, oh, good enough is good enough. I'm like, I like to say like, hey, might as well go for the, you know, higher quality equipment, because you are yourself a canvas to talk about history. So would you rather cheap out on the canvas and tell a, you know, more or less junky story, or do you want to just really go all out on the canvas and tell a great story, so to say?
Absolutely. And especially when you're representing those who went through what they did during the Civil War, it's a tribute to them, right? So you want to make sure you get it right.
Also too, like, especially since you're going to be standing out as an ethnic minority in reenacting, I think people might take a more critical eye towards you. You know, they might say, are you supposed to be here? Or like, oh, you know, they might not say anything, but they might judge a little harder. So I say, bring it on. And like, be the best, basically.
Well, I have to say that I have seen images of you and your kit representing multiple different time periods. I can definitely say that we see it in your canvas. You definitely take it to the next level. It is spot on. And anyone who would want to get tips on nailing their impression, I would say definitely go to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us this untold Civil War story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening while you went pumpkin picking, toasting mugs of apple cider, discussing whether coffee tastes better when the water is gathered from upstream versus downstream with your fellow pards, painting the latest battle honor on your colors, or whenever you listen to podcasts. I hope you enjoyed this episode and tune in next time. Please share this podcast with your friends. Let's keep Untold Civil War alive.